welcome back to another episode of Monkology for the Inquisitive Mind. It is a beautiful sunny day here down under. As always, we're going to ramble a bit, but today we are doing our second ASCO GU, so genitourinary cancers 2024 spectacular. Looking at me with his beautiful brown eyes is Dr. Michael Fernando. Michael, thank you for joining me here in the studio. How are you?
Yes, we have a studio of our own, kind of. It's a whole other story, which we won't bore our listeners with, but it is a lovely sunny day down here, Josh, and I'm very excited to talk about some genitourinary stuff because we promised our listeners that we'd only do two episodes, so we should probably actually start talking about the GU.
Yeah, well, let it flow. What's your title of your article today?
Well, I've always thought, Josh, that we were ambassadors for general oncology education, and that is the name of this study. And he's giving me a big thumbs up because I have turned into him, basically. I've become unto Josh. But the ambassador study is what I'm going to talk to, and this is an interim analysis of a phase 3 study that compares pembrolizumab versus observation as adjuvant therapy for high-risk muscle-invasive urothelial cancer. So we've had pembrolizumab in the second line, we've had avelumab in the first line, and now pembro is trying to nudge its way even before the cancer has recurred or metastasized. So creeping earlier, Josh. The background here is that the current standard of care for muscle-invasive urothelial cancer is radical surgery plus minus neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Many patients are not eligible for neoadjuvant chemotherapy or have persistent disease afterward.
And it's probably important to highlight that the surgery is really, really invasive. Cystectomies are less than fun and it is a lifelong challenge.
They are pretty brutal. And so you want to maximize your therapy, and neoadjuvant chemotherapy in this space is a major step forward because it can reduce the invasiveness, the morbidity of surgery. However, there are still a lot of improvements that can be made. The backbone of neoadjuvant chemotherapy is of course cisplatin, but there are a lot of issues, as we've talked about previously, with cisplatin. It is very nephrotoxic, very ototoxic, and really tends to have more toxicity and less efficacy in patients who are older with poorer performance status. And so finding a way to maximize therapy in a non-toxic way, I guess, given that the majority of patients who have urothelial cancer are older and tend to be more frail, is very important. So the study schema, we've already rambled with our introduction here, Josh, so I'll try and whiz through this a bit.
That was a good one.
Yeah, that was completely unintentional. I'm just a natural. So the ambassador study was a randomized phase 3 study, as we said, of adjuvant pembrolizumab in high-risk muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Patients who were enrolled had MIUC who had undergone radical cystectomy, nephrectomy, nephrourectomy, or ureterectomy. Within 4 to 16 weeks of enrollment. And that's just a reminder to our listeners that urothelial cancer does not necessarily mean bladder cancer. You can have cancer of a urothelial urothelial histology all the way up to the nephrons, effectively, or the ureters. They had to have post-neoadjuvant chemotherapy and had to have a greater than or equal to PT2 and or node positive disease, residual disease, or positive margins, or they had to be cisplatin ineligible. Or they could have a PT3 disease with or without node positivity and positive margins after receiving cisplatin. So smaller cancer, less disease if they couldn't have cisplatin, or bigger cancer if they did. In total, 702 patients were recruited and randomized to receive pembrolizumab standard dosing every 3 weeks for a year versus observation. Primary endpoints were overall survival and disease-free survival. Secondary endpoints were overall survival and disease-free survival in the PD-L1 positive and PD-L1 negative cohorts and safety. Josh, I think we can already guess what the safety profile is going to be given we know what pembrolizumab is like.
Like every other trial ever.
Every other immunotherapy trial. Well, pretty much every other trial ever these days.
Because they're all pembro.
Because they're all pembro.
Yeah.
Pembro is really getting a monopoly. The baseline characteristics were pretty well balanced across the two groups. A couple of things to point out here is that, as we've mentioned before, over 90% of patients, or close to 90% of patients in both groups, were Caucasian, which is obviously an ongoing thing that we have pointed out multiple times. 75% of patients, give or take, were male in both groups, pretty typical for urothelial cancer. And about two-thirds of patients in both groups had had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The majority of patients had node-positive disease at about half of the total group in both pembrolizumab and observation groups, and the vast majority of the remainder had T2 or 3 disease with no nodes involved. The primary tumor site was the bladder in 3/4 of patients in both groups. So the median disease-free survival, let's get right down to the juicy part, as we are fond of saying on this show. The median disease-free survival in the pembrolizumab group was 29 months, compared to 14 months in the observation group. So that is more than double. The hazard ratio was 0.69 with a p-value of 0.001. Very statistically significant. In terms of the DFS subgroups, the hazard ratio was greatest in patients who were younger than 65 or greater than 75. And I think we can sort of read a bit into why that may have been the case. Younger than 65, you're generally going to have more aggressive disease biology, and so more treatment with immunotherapy is going to have a greater benefit. Greater than 75, I'd be willing to bet good money that most of those patients were cisplatin ineligible. And so it's basically the difference between surgery alone versus surgery plus immunotherapy. The hazard ratios, by the way, for those two groups were 0.65 and 0.57 respectively. In terms of ECOG performance status, patients who had an ECOG performance status of 0 had a hazard ratio of 0.68, as did patients with an ECOG performance status of 1. Interestingly, patients with ECOG of 2 had a hazard ratio of 0.91, with a range of 0.32 to 2.71. Admittedly, though, there were only 19 patients.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there like just one person in this trial that's actually an ECOG 2?
Well, no, because then the range would be just that person's result.
There are two people.
There will be three people.
There are three people.
One at one end, one at the other end, and one right in the middle.
Yeah.
So in terms of patients who had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, pretty much the same whether they did or didn't, which is actually very interesting. So hazard ratio for patients with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, 0.69, without 0.7. Interestingly, the patients who had very large primary tumours, what I mean by very large is T4, with node-negative disease, again, very small numbers with only 20 cases in both groups, the hazard ratio was 1.12. Probably can't draw too many conclusions from there, but it was interesting. In all of the other sort of disease stages, the hazard ratio was very robust. For patients with positive surgical margins, again, small numbers, but the hazard ratio was 0.31. And in terms of the primary tumour site, upper tract disease tended to do worse with a hazard ratio of 1.05. And I suspect that's just because upper tract cancers tend to be less responsive and be more aggressive than lower urinary tract cancers in terms of disease biology. In terms of the PD-L1 status, patients who were PD-L1 positive had a hazard ratio of 0.77. with a median DFS of 32.8 versus 20 months. PD-L1 negative patients, however, had a hazard ratio of 0.61. And you'd think, oh, well, wow, you know, PD-L1 doesn't matter. However, wow, exactly, says Josh. Thank you for your contribution.
No worries.
But if you actually look at the numbers, patients who are PD-L1 negative had a DFS with 22 months on Pembro compared to 32, and a DFS, an abysmal DFS of 9.1 months. On observation.
Yeah, so the disease-free survival is definitely swayed towards those that have a higher PD-L1 status.
Numerically, yes. Numerically. But the degree of benefit, interestingly, is greater in the PD-L1 negative group, which suggests that there are other things that dictate a cancer's responsiveness to PD-L1 blockade than just PD-L1 by itself.
Which we sort of already knew.
Which we knew, but I just wanted to sound smart.
Okay, sounds good.
And mysterious. The overall survival remains immature, so I won't go into great depth with all of the subgroups, but numerically much better in the pembrolizumab group with an overall survival of 29 months compared to 14 months, but with a overall survival hazard ratio of 0.98 and a p-value of 0.884.
So it's a watch this space, really.
Very much a watch this space. In terms of other systemic therapy, Josh, because you, in the last episode, quizzed me on this. As one would expect for patients in the observation group, about 20-25% of them had checkpoint inhibitors. 10% went on to chemotherapy, whereas in the pembrolizumab group, only 5 patients had additional checkpoint inhibitor. The patients in the pembro group tend to get more antibody drug conjugates, presumably sacituzumab govitecan, which has gotten evidence there in the IMMU trials. Adverse events, we said this right at the beginning.
They're the same.
Exactly what we would expect.
Immune-related adverse events.
Yes, immune-related adverse events, probably affecting around 10 to 15, 20% of patients.
Except for endocrinopathies, which can affect up to 40%.
Up to 40, 50. In practice,
100.
Yeah, honestly, it's pretty close. So the conclusions from the Ambassador trial. So a very interesting trial, sort of a natural progression of our urothelial cancer treatments. There is a significant improvement in median disease-free survival with adjuvant pembrolizumab. And interestingly, they've highlighted, as we mentioned, the efficacy was similar in terms of magnitude of benefit as opposed to numerically, regardless of the PD-L1 expression level. Overall survival endpoint was numerically higher, but it's only an interim analysis. So it's still not statistically significant, but it's probably going to be.
Yeah.
And then there's also the confounding factor that patients, after they progressed, got immunotherapy. So that will reduce the magnitude of benefit theoretically. But as we've seen before, as we've said before, frequently getting these treatments earlier increases their effectiveness.
That's it.
Yeah. So, Josh, I have been an ambassador for the Ambassador trial. I have promoted it to our listeners. What study do you have?
Well, I think I had a great segue. I'm going to break away from the Ambassador. You know, we're going to leave your continent and head to mine, which is the prostate world. But I'm going to be talking about the BRCA away study. So BRCA, you know, essentially looking at patients that have the BRCA mutation and whether the addition of olaparib either as a single agent or in combination with their androgen receptor signaling inhibitor does better. So the premise of this trial, randomized, open label, multi-center, phase 2. So look, it's not huge yet, but potentially in those with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer who have a germline or a somatic mutation in the BRCA1/2 or ATM mutations. And what happened is that these people could not have had prior exposure to any of these drugs. They had to have washout from their anti-androgens, and there were 61 patients randomized to 3 arms. The first arm was single agent abiraterone at 1,000 milligrams a day. The second arm was 300 milligrams twice a day of olaparib. And the third arm was a combination of these two. So evenly divided, let's be honest, and they were continued until they progressed. First issue with this trial is that it's already in the castrate-resistant setting. Abiraterone, like a lot of the drugs, are moving into the sensitive space, and so this is probably done before all that data became available. The primary endpoints, Michael, who's looking at me so attentively, thank you, was progression-free survival, and the secondary endpoint, or key secondary endpoints, was objective response rate, PSA response rate, and safety. So looking at this, again, like what Michael said, predominantly Caucasian. I think it's almost the same ratio as what you got, Michael. Most people had an ECOG of 0 or 1, and the median PSA was sort of 14 between the different groups. Predominant size of sites of metastatic disease include that of bone, lymph node, and then a smaller amount was the viscera. Of note, the olaparib arm, so the combination arm, actually had quite high levels. That sort of was similar between the different arms. Measurable disease was seen in almost half of each of the different cohorts groups. And previous treatment included docetaxel in 40% of those that were on the abiraterone arm, far less in the olaparib and the abiraterone combination, and other agents in about 10 and 15%. So of note, only one patient had received darolutamide or enzalutamide, which is sort of in keeping with the known data that rechallenging with these drugs doesn't potentially work, but I'll watch this space. So looking at the outcomes, let's just talk about the results, Michael, because they're important. The median...
They're kind of what people tune in for.
Yeah, yeah. The median progression-free survival, and I'll go through A, B, and C, or 1, 2, and 3.
So how, creatively named.
Thank you. One, which was single agent abiraterone, 8.4 months. B, olaparib, up to 14 months, or that was the median. And then three, which is the combination, 39 months and not reached. The objective response rate was 22% in the abiraterone arm, 14% in the olaparib, and 33% in the combination arm. And PSA response was seen in 95% of those that had the combination arm. So that's really, really good. And I think I'm just going to not add too many more details. But what you can see is the combination therapy was inherently better than either single agent therapy. So what it says here, participants receiving combination therapy had significantly greater PFS or progression-free survival compared to those receiving either single agent, with a hazard ratio of the abiraterone and olaparib versus abiraterone alone of 0.28. Not bad. And the abiraterone plus olaparib versus olaparib alone of 0.32. Not bad.
Has it gotten to the point where a hazard ratio of 0.28 and 0.32 is classed as not bad?
Yeah, no, right.
It's sort of meh.
It's the PSA world. So it's the prostate world, which I actually quite love. So there was crossover allowed between arms. In arm one, which was the abiraterone, 8 patients crossed over. In arm two, another 8 patients crossed over. The crossover, you still saw an objective response rate to olaparib of 38%, and those that crossed over to the abiraterone, there was a response rate of 25%. So still not bad, and you still had at least half the patients have a PSA response rate.
So presumably when you're talking about crossover, they go from olaparib to doublet?
No,
olaparib to single. Right. So yes. It's sequential versus combination is
yeah.
What you sort of...
That's my understanding, but happy for anyone to email me if I'm wrong.
Josh's email is joshua.hurwitz@joshhurwitz.com.
That's how much I love myself. Looking at the adverse events, and this is probably important in this trial because combination therapy, more toxicity. So combination therapy, grade 1 to 3, you saw an adverse event in at least 95%, but olaparib was in at least 90%, and then abiraterone was sort of 58%. The most common things you saw in the combination arm was anemia, anorexia, fatigue, nausea, hot flushes, and hypertension, and they're grade 1 to grade 3, but far fewer in the grade 3 related cohort. So what they found, grade 3 increased liver function dysfunction. So ALT was observed in 11% and AST in 5.3% of the abiraterone arm. Edema was seen in 11%, 4.8% and 14% in all three arms respectively. So highest in the combination arm. And there was no grade 4 or grade 5 related adverse events. Let's talk about the conclusion. It's been fast. I'm sorry, everyone. But I think the important point is... progression-free survival was blown out of the water in the combination in this space. The toxicity all actually seems relatively manageable. And what they found is that those that were treated in the combination resulted in longer progression-free survival and a higher objective response rate versus single agent alone in this cohort of patients with known mutations. The median progression-free survival was 39 months versus 8.4 months in the abiraterone and 14 months in the olaparib arm, and sequential treatment with olaparib and abiraterone or vice versa resulted in shorter median progression-free survival from randomization than the combination therapy.
So, Josh, sorry, you might have said it. Did they make special mention in the arms that received olaparib about myelodysplastic syndromes and AML?
They have not actually mentioned it in the... But they've grouped it as adverse events in those with greater than 15% of patients.
Okay, and you wouldn't expect greater than 15% incidence of MDS or AMLs.
Yeah, it would be a little concern, a little concerning.
So, Josh, this is sort of the counterpunch to the Talipro study, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That is the question. So, speaking of, what does this mean, right, in our treatment options? So there's been a huge number of PARP inhibitor trials, been Propel, Profound, Magnitude, Talipro 2, which was the ENZA combination, or the talazoparib and ENZA combination. And realistically, these aren't head-to-head trials. So I'm not going to go into that progression-free survival. But what is interesting is they're now looking at PARP inhibitors in the metastatic castrate-sensitive space. So coming back to this, we're breaking away, going back to the top again. This is the interesting thing. So they're looking at talazoparib in that space. They're looking at now abiraterone and talazoparib in an unselected population, which is also an interesting thing. Mm. Do you have to have the BRCA mutation in order to benefit?
Evidence would suggest yes, but you never know.
Well, that's exactly the same as PD-1 stuff. Like, you still have these benefits and you're not sure why. So there's the Triumph, there's a couple of NCT trials, there's Amplitude and Talipro 3 if you're looking for a couple of them. But it's an interesting space, combination therapy in this cohort of patients who generally have more aggressive disease.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a reminder for everyone listening is...
test yourself.
Exactly. Test yourself before you wreck yourself. So if you have a patient with prostate cancer, it is now standard procedure to test them and test them early. And I guess the main thing would be that it'd just be down to what you can access,
yeah,
really. Because just glancing, and I know you said we wouldn't do this, but just glancing at the Talipro 2 results, the initial data results in terms of PFS, broadly similar.
Mm.
Maybe numerically, the Brackaway study was a bit better, but you're probably going to get a similar degree of benefit. Was there any data on you mentioned ATM mutation.
Yeah.
Was there any data on non-BRCA HRDs? Because we know in the ovarian space that you don't, coming back to not needing a BRCA mutation, but if you have a HRD, that's homologous repair deficiency, then you can still get some benefit. But I don't know if they were specifically looking at that here.
They did not. They didn't mention it at all, but it is another good point to bring up.
Yeah. So you're talking about sort of expanding the net for PARP inhibitors in this space, that might be a way to do it.
That's it. And it seems, you know, touching wood, etc., toxicities seem on par. But look, you know, is abiraterone my go-to these days? Probably isn't.
No, you like darolutamide.
I do. I mean, maybe it's just I did a lot of trials with them, but yeah, I think they're all pretty similar. But yeah, just, you know, the ones that you can set and forget are my favorite.
And each of them does have a slightly different toxicity profile. So as we've said before, tailoring that to your patient, what they can and cannot tolerate might inform your decision.
Yep. Well, there you have it. Another ASCO GU done and
that's
dusted.
The way it is.
That's the way it is.
Join us next time on Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, when we'll be talking about some of the second line data in melanoma. There's a couple of interesting combinations that have come out not too long ago, and we figured we'd talk about what happens in a BRAF wild-type patient once immunotherapy stops working.
Good point, Michael. We haven't done a lot of melanoma, so this might be a little mini-series. We'll figure it out on the way.
Well, surely our listeners realize by now that we're just flying by the seat of our pants. We don't really have a plan for this at all.
That's it. We'll see you next week.
See you next time. Thank you for listening to this episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonc.com, that's inquisitiveonc.com, for links to all of our previous episodes. You'll find links to our social media there as well. If you'd like a particular subject covered on the show, feel free to drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonc or via email at inquisitiveonc@gmail.com. This has been Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a podcast by ADC Productions.